Through dangers untold and hardships unnumbered, we have fought our way here to the castle beyond the Goblin City to break down Labyrinth and take back the childhood that you have stolen. For our will is as strong as yours, and our kingdom is great. Our kingdom is great. Damn it, I can never remember that line. Episode 1, start.
Hi, I'm Elwood.
And I'm Emily.
And you're listening to Through Dangers Untold, which we break in down the classic fantasy movie Labyrinth. And Emily, I just have to say, it's a great pleasure, of course, to be working with you on this project, because we are both self-confessed obsessives of this movie that has been such an integral part of our childhoods, it seems, and only carried through into adult life. So where did the obsession begin for yourself when it came to Labyrinth?
Oh my god, like, is obsession even the word? Like, I think there's a word that needs to be invented that's like three tiers above the word obsession. So I used to do karate, and when I did karate there was a girl there that I used to spar with, and we got talking about movies one day, and she mentioned this movie called Labyrinth, and I was like, I don't know what that is, and I was about 13 at the time. And she brought in her VHS copy that she had recorded off the television of Labyrinth. And I borrowed it, and I went home, and I watched it. And then I rewound it, and I watched it again. And I did this 8 times that day. She let me keep it for a week. I watched it twice a day, every day. On the Friday, I gave it back to her. On the Saturday, I was in HMV buying my own copy of the DVD. I then spent the weekend watching it. I used to keep it in my bag and take it places. So whenever there was like a lull in conversation, I would be like, does anyone want to watch Labyrinth? Have you seen Labyrinth? Maybe we should just watch it. I showed it to my boyfriend at the time. I showed it to my parents. I showed it to my sister. I showed it to my friends. I showed it to anyone that stood still long enough near a DVD player for me to be able to put it in and sit them down and be like, you're about to have your fucking mind blown. This is the greatest movie of all time ever made. Like, it just was, to me, the most magical, the most beautiful, the most powerful movie I had ever seen. I related to the character of Sarah in a way that I had never related to a character on screen before, and I will be getting emotional in every single episode of this podcast.
And that is just what you call a perfect co-host for this kind of project, because it takes a certain sign of crazy to really get in, do a minute-by-minute sort of breakdown like this. We are actually doing a slight twist on the old rules, as we're going to be breaking this down one DVD chapter at a time, very similar to other podcasts in the community, such as, you know, the Deep Blue Sea podcast, who initially inspired this format for myself, and obviously my other breakdown, the Battle Royale podcast, which I co-host with Stephen, my co-host Stephen Palmer over at the Asian Cinema Film Club. So if you can't get enough of my dulcet tones, you can go and listen to me ruin another of your favourite movies over there.
We're not ruining this. We are going to expose it. We're going to lovingly peel it apart layer by layer and just fill the vicinity with glitter and love, and then just like re-consume it. Like, that's how I'm thinking. That's how I'm visualizing it right now.
Yeah.
Because I just watched a documentary to get some information that I needed, and I started crying when they showed me a puppet, and they were like, this is a really complicated puppet. And I was like, so that's the sort of level that we're at the moment. I'm not quite sure Elwood knows what he's gotten himself into. This movie changed my life. Like, not to be dramatic, but it changed my life. So.
Oh, this movie, it's been in my life for, like, so long, I can't even, like, really remember a time when it wasn't in my life. And it was sort of, like, one of those random videos that my dad, like, had rented from the video store. Because he was a big fantasy and a big sci-fi sort of nerd. And through him, I got exposed to a lot of these things. And Labyrinth just happened to be one of those films. And I remember first time I seen it, and I was always like a big monster kid. If there was like a monster or a Ray Harryhausen effect in something, they always had my interest a lot more than if you didn't include these elements in a film. So when you have something like Labyrinth, which is just full of monsters and unusual creatures and fantasy worlds, and it just really, something about it just really appealed to myself. And I think because it was obviously Jim Henson and obviously the Muppets, your parents let you, would like over you watching it, and then they would like put on the Dark Crystal because you liked the Labyrinth so much, and then you were just horribly scarred for life by what they'd done prior to this movie. And I mean, when you watch it, I mean, I had no idea who David Bowie was when I saw this. I just knew that I enjoyed the songs in this film. I never made any connection to him having a larger career outside of Labyrinth.
Yeah, I don't know much of his music career. Obviously, he was an absolute icon, a really lovely person, a real professional within the industry. And I think I was aware, you know, I'd heard Life on Mars, and I like knew that that was David Bowie, and I knew that he was like a person. But to me, he's always been Jareth the Goblin King. Like, that's just who he is. And then when he had to pretend to be a human, he would be David Bowie in real life.
Yeah.
But he has just returned to the Goblin City. That's all he's done. He didn't, you know, pass away. He's just returned to his sort of home kingdom in my head.
And I think this is the great thing about having Bowie as Jareth the Goblin King, because he was so synonymous with playing different roles through the phases of his career. So he was like, he was Ziggy Stardust, he was Aladdin Sade, he was, you know, the Thin White Duke. He just had all these different sort of personas. So to have someone like Jareth, and it be so self-contained, like an album, that it made absolutely perfect sense. It just fit completely within his repertoire. And as we always used to say, it was sort of like, he's still the alien, but at least he wants to talk to us now, when it got into like his later albums. Say, when you look at his other films that he's done, it's just been an incredible body of work, not only with the music, but outside of that. When he did, obviously, like The Man Who Fell to Earth and Merry Christmas, Mr. Lawrence, and even like The Snowman. I mean, the fact he's in the Snowman, and I don't think any of us as kids knew it was David Bowie. It's just...
No, just grown-up James, there he is.
Yeah, exactly. Just some nice man who's going to tell us about this time he built a snowman.
How we got this scarf,
He's like Bing Crosby.
So good.
That's what we all basically are. We're just like this very nice man.
And I mean, the soundtrack to this movie is one that I've listened to. I think the only thing that beats it in terms of number of listens for me is the Lord of the Rings soundtrack. Because I had this soundtrack on all the time. And I mean, from start to finish, I didn't just skip through to listen to Dance Magic Dance. Like, the whole... every bit of instrumental, every Into the Labyrinth, the song Underground, like every single part of this album to me was so important and part of the story and created the world. Like, I really felt from the second it started, and I won't go into it too much because we're going to break it down in a sec, but I was just instantly in a different world. And that is all I was about when I was a young teenager. I just didn't want to be here, so I was like, excellent, I'll go there instead. And the soundtrack really kicks that off before you've even seen any visuals. And it's so great that they got David Bowie, because you hear about who they considered casting, and they thought about Sting and they thought about Michael Jackson, and they just, you know, they wanted Bowie, they pushed for him, and I'm so happy that he got them. In the documentary, he mentions how, you know, they showed him Dark Crystal and they showed him this concept art, and he was like, I just thought it was a remarkable piece of art. And, you know, I couldn't really say no, because he was the woman being against the norm. And that's why he resonated with so many people. And that's what this movie is to me as well. It's like people doing cool shit that they enjoy because they have to. And that's why David Bowie is such a good part of it, because it's like, yeah, it's just like cool people doing fun stuff and like talking to the other people that are like, well, I like doing that, but it's like frowned upon.
Oh yeah,
but
definitely.
We can do it here together, and we've got these role models.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, when you think back to our childhoods and stuff, it's like, if you were like into fantasy and stuff, it's not like now where you like go to Comic-Con and it's like all the cool kids want to go and hang out and dress as favorite characters from like Lord of the Rings or Marvel movies. It's sort of like back then it was a very underground thing, and it was normally sort of like something like the secret handshake between like the underdog kids. This idea of you escaping into worlds, which I guess now has been replaced with this idea of you escaping into video games and you being good at video games being that means you're good in these worlds, as we've seen with like Sword Art Online and such. But with when I think back to like when this film came out in like the sort of like the mid 80s, and much like Neverending Story and Flight of Dragons, it's all just this idea of escaping into fantasy worlds, escaping from reality and responsibility, and often like tormentors to go to somewhere else and be recognized for, you know, the great person that you essentially are, or to, in Sarah's case, to really sort of discover something about yourself.
Yeah, for sure. It's that coming of age movie. It's that Dorothy Gale going into Oz. And what's wonderful is that for this movie, they talk about how it was inspired by the guy that wrote Where the Wild Things Are. He did like a sort of trilogy of books that were essentially sort of the coming of age stories of a child's psychological like development, essentially. And one of them was a young girl whose young sister is kidnapped by goblins, and Where the Wild Things Are is in Sarah's room. So it's, you know, it's all sort of connected and homaged and inspired by, and it's all the same thing. And it is very much about like the development of the person. And she doesn't sort of, there's the two different ones, aren't there? The stories of the fantasy world. There's the sort of things happen to you and then you leave. And then there's the like, you are the catalyst and you have an effect in this world, and then you learn something about yourself and then you leave. And it's definitely in the latter part for sure.
And it's great when you look at like the influences in here. I mean, it's not obviously just the traditional sort of fantasy ones like Grimm's Fairy Tales and Alice in Wonderland. You mentioned already, you've got Maurice Sendak's Where the Wild Things Are and his less recognized book Outside Over There, which really sort of form that sort of foundation there, so much so that it led to some minor legal trouble with Sendak, who believed that they were trying to rip off his idea, but he managed to end up smoothing itself out in the end. But there's also a lot of other influences in there, like you got elements of kabuki theater, you've got even like references to things such like Wuthering Heights in there as well. So it goes on, it goes a lot sort of deeper than I think a lot of sort of fantasy ones, which were kind of in the same, that sort of like token-esque world of, you know, magic and swords and fantasy and creatures. And I think with this one, it was trying to bring sort of like expand the sort of scope slightly. And when it came to obviously making this film, I mean, there were obviously both Henson and Brian Froud, who's the conceptual designer, were coming off Dark Crystal, which had unintentionally become a lot darker than they originally planned, and they wanted to do something lighter, a little more of a comedic sort of slant, but nothing that could be linked with the Muppets. They wanted the Muppets completely separate from this, so Henson brought in completely different puppeteers, different voice actors to really put a distance between them. And it was Froud coming up with this idea of a baby surrounded by goblins that sort of sparked that initial catalyst of what they were going to do. And it was basically from there they were sort of off to the races, really, with the original script being put together by both Froud and the children's author Dennis Lee. And afterwards it was passed on to Terry Jones of Monty Python fame, who had just done Eric the Viking, and Henson's daughter had passed the script to him, and they basically found what they were looking for, as someone to sort of touch the script. And Jones basically put a script together and really gave the sort of foundation for the film, even though by the time it came to the shooting script, you'd also had contributions from George Lucas, Laura Phillips, and Elaine May to really sort of move it away from what Jones had originally envisioned, which was more of the world at large being corrupted by Jaffa and the Labyrinth, whereas the revised sort of script gave it a much more intimate sort of journey, and we focused more on Sarah. And some of the script difference in the script, we're obviously going to focus on as we come to them, because I think Otherwise, this is going to be like a really long breakdown of just a production. So,
yeah, and I think a project often, I know there's this sort of phrase, too many cooks spoil the broth, but I actually find that the more people work on things, the better things are, because you take the best of everyone's ideas and you put them together, and that's really how it feels. I absolutely love the idea that it was Brian Froud's concept art that was then given to Terry Jones, and the two never met, but Terry Jones would sit there and look at the images and the drawings and create creatures and scenes and things for Sarah to interact with just off of these images, and it was a real collaboration even though they never spoke to one another. Yeah. And I just think that there's something really magical about that.
Definitely. So, and it's also nice the fact that while you've obviously got an additional three people working on the script, it's not become a contest of who can change it the most to get like the lead credit here. It feels, as you say, it feels like a very sort of team effort that everyone sort of brought their different elements and strengths to this sort of script to craft this world between them. And I think in many ways, I think that's why The Labyrinth is such a in-depth world, because you haven't just got one person sort of ideas going into it. You've got all these different ideas being thrown into the mix, and I think this is what's great about The Labyrinth, is that just as you get sort of used to what's going on, the whole surroundings have changed. You enter into a different area and it'd be all completely new all over again. So
yeah, it's like Disneyland. You're like, 1 minute you're in Tomorrowland, then you're in Fantasyland, then you're in like the animal bit, then you're in like by a petting farm, and then you're back up by like Escape, like, yeah, it's great. Like, every scene you're in a different location, essentially, but it's all this one labyrinth. So obviously we know that Jennifer Connelly ended up getting the role, and you can watch her original audition on YouTube, and you really do, you can see the feeling in the room of the people watching being like, yes. Because one thing you always forget as an actor, people don't want the bad person to walk in. They don't want you to fail. The casting director doesn't want an actor to turn up and not be what they're looking for. They want to find their perfect actor. They want to find their perfect Sarah. And they were auditioning all of the sort of big names of the, well, they're big names now. I don't know how big they were back in the 1980s, some more so than others. And I wish we could see all of their original auditions as well. You know, you've got Laura Dern, Ali Sheedy, who I think would have done a really solid take on it, Mia Sara, who was doing Legend, so she's sort of doing her 80s fantasy, and now I can't extract her from that, so I can't see her as Sarah Jessica Parker, who I just cannot. if it's Flight of the Navigator Sarah Jessica Parker, then I'm not here for it. Jane Krakowski, who I adore now, she had this massive perm back in the 80s, and again, I can't really picture it, which isn't very fair, because I'm sure they all would have done a decent job. But Jennifer Connelly, who wasn't an actor, she was a model, and then she did a couple of adverts, and then she sort of landed a film audition, as models so often do. And I mean, lucky for us, she was an incredibly mature, professional young woman who was also blindingly beautiful and incredibly talented. And she managed to ride this line of, Henson called it the dawn twilight time between childhood and womanhood, which is so nice. And I really think that she's perfectly cast in this film.
And I think it's absolutely perfect as well when you look at the main sort of theme of it. I mean, as when she was discussing the role with Elle, she basically said the film is about a young girl growing up out of her childhood who is now becoming aware of the responsibilities that come with growing up. And I think that's perfectly describes Sarah's journey in many ways without getting too deep in at this point into this. And I think there's a lot of elements of this story that you sort of dawn on you as you become an older viewer. I think when you first watch as a child, you think, oh, this is just a wonderful light fantasy romp, and then you return to it in various stages of adulthood and you start realizing different things. And I always love it when, you know, writing's able to operate on multiple levels, and I think it's something that I think the best stories often do. They give you something to return to. I mean, you look at Lord of the Rings, for example, and it's, on one hand, it's this epic fantasy tale, and then we can obviously take the more academic route and break down what the symbolism of all the different elements of it, you know, the Fellowship of the Ring being this representative of the brothers in arms of like the World War One trenches, where his son was obviously serving, and the original stories were sent as this sort of like morale boost. But these ideas of like war and how power corrupts, that you can obviously take from that story. And the same with Labyrinth. Labyrinth's got its own themes and ideas within it, but you can still at the same time just watch it as this wonderful, humorous fantasy.
Yeah, definitely.
Should we take our first steps into the Labyrinth then and get started on this journey?
Come on, feet! I'm going to be quoting the hell out of this movie at any given opportunity.
I'm just going to let you get on with it, because it sounds a lot better than if I try to quote any of these, that's for sure, because you've been the experienced actor amongst us.
Also, just obsessively watching this movie and getting a lot of my acting ability from Jennifer Connelly's performance, and then not being very flexible when it comes to my own acting ability, because I'm like, I want to do it like Jennifer Connelly in Labyrinth, because that's what I know. It's either that or Emma Watson in The Philosopher's Stone, so...
That's funny, because... I get a lot of my general demeanor from Hoggle, so we both took something away.
Episode one, the first chapter of the DVD menu is called Start, which I think is very good. You know, you get what you came for. They don't shy around with what we're about to watch. And as I mentioned earlier, like, it's just instantly this sort of like unveiling of a melody where it's like dun 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 dun, and instantly I'm like, yeah, like whatever you've got going from here, I'm on board. Like, it just draws you in immediately with just that opening like riff, and you've got the like sparkly blue text that's sort of coming up, and then the credit, the title. Very simply designed, like nothing overt or fancy, just black background, blue writing, so simple. And then, of course, the owl. Do you want to talk about the owl?
Well, I mean, the owl, this is the, again, we forget this is the early days of CGI. So this was one of the first CGI owls, if not the first, one of the first CGI animals ever put on film. And it makes its wonderful debut during these opening credits, which I always remember skipping through as a child. I never was like, I was never drawn through. I was just like, God, skip to the, get to the park already.
Because no, these are just names. I can't remember who said it.
This is like...
I know, yeah. And especially in the 80s, credits had gotten, they were moving along to the end of movies now, because I watched a lot of Rodgers and Hammerstein when I was a kid, and that's like very like Judy Garland movies, all these big old set movies, Gone with the Wind, that had the entire credit sequence at the beginning of the movie. So then when the movie ends, it just ends. And I always really liked that.
Yeah.
And I was used to it. So when the credits were at the beginning of Labyrinth, I wasn't like instantly turned off by it or bored or anything. I sort of was like, yeah, it's a movie. Like, credits can be at the beginning of a movie. And I think it was Tarantino. I could be completely making this up, but Edgar Wright was doing Scott Pilgrim versus the World in 2010. And I want to say Quentin Tarantino, but that sounds a little too convenient, visited him. And they showed him early cuts early rushes and cuts of the movie. And Tarantino apparently said, get yourself some opening credits, because it needs to feel like we're stepping into an event. And Tarantino will often do big, long opening credits sequences. Yeah. And I love it. I think it really, it's like a prologue in a book, or it's like a overture when you go to the theater. Like, you need that little preamble to sort of ease yourself into your seat. It allows you to have an idea of what kind of thing you're about to be seeing. So the Scott Pilgrim credits, if we take them an example, are completely opposite to Labyrinth. They're very loud and flashy, and they're like coming towards you. Whereas Labyrinth is, you are sort of meandering through this almost pathway of like text that's just sort of appearing magically with this synth. And so I'm a big fan of the opening credits, and I really love, you know, we were joking that there wasn't going to be much to say about this episode in terms of the movie because the chapter is so short, but it's not. It's because 85% of it is taken up with credits, which I never skipped. saying that, I am now a skip intro person in Netflix, but, you know, people change.
Having the big credits at the start, if you're watching things that are double feature, I have to say that just having, like, the end credit and then it's just end the movie there is so much better when you're doing double features. So when you watch, like, a lot of Shaw Brothers movies and you just have that end credit, or you watch B movies and you just have, like, the end and normally with a big question mark, it's so great because you're then straight into the next film. Whereas if you have, like, the big long credit sequences, it's giving you too much of a break and giving you too much time to think and play with your phone and stuff, and I like it just going, you know, we're done with one thing, now on to the next thing. So I agree with both. I just don't know what it was about the Labyrinth credits. I think I was just too impatient to get back to my fantasy friends.
They are, yeah, and they're boring. Like, if you want to take away all the emotional implications that I put on them, they are just boring. It's a song that doesn't really have words, and it's just blue text with an awful CGI owl dipping in and out. And it's like, no one needs to see who produced this movie. Like, I completely get it. And considering how many times I watched this, there probably was a few times that I skipped them as well. But yeah, I just felt I needed to put a pin in the credits are important, but I completely understand if you skip them because they're not doing much beyond, you know, you've seen the first slide of credits, you get the gist.
Yeah. The actual credits themselves is kind of noteworthy if you're a fan of, you know, people who do CGI and that kind of thing. So they're created by Larry Yeager and Bill Croyer. Bill Croyer is most noteworthy for doing the effects in the original Tron. But yes,
hold
it's Mark's
phone. Yes! Oh my god! I didn't even realise. Okay, so Bill Croyer. Oh my god, everything's coming up, Milhouse. This is amazing. Bill Croyer was the founder of Croyer Films, who, yeah, worked on Tron, and they bloody did Fern Gully, The Last Rainforest, and he did the credits for Labyrinth. Oh my god! All my heroes are in the same place! That's lovely.
I don't think we've ever done a podcast where you've not managed to work Fern Gully into the proceedings, so...
Honestly, I'm, like, renowned for it. Like...
Yeah.
Like, slipping Fern Gully into casual conversation is, like, my skill. It's, like, on my CV. Like, that's what I should be employed to do. I'm that good at it.
Yeah.
First lockdown, I did quizzes to my friends on a Friday. They knew it was coming, without doubt. Regardless of the theme, there would be a Fern Gully question. And I do not apologize for that. Fern Gully is great. Go watch it.
Let me just put this into context. The last time we hung out was for Kaiju Christmas, and we were talking about Pulgasara, the North Korean kaiju movie, and you still managed to work Fern Gully into the discussion.
Yep.
The movie where the main thing I remember is, hey, look, there's a little man sliding down the window. And the two most unaware workmen who, despite the apocalypse erupting around them, are still like, yeah, just another day at the office.
It's great.
No, let's haul ass out of it.
I love it. I love that he did the opening credits Labyrinth. I never knew that. That's amazing. That's made me so happy. See, this movie is just perfect.
Yeah.
And we haven't even gotten to the first scene yet.
Well, the Owlhead Marquette had to be rescued from a skip when Omnibus, the animation company behind the effect, went bankrupt in 1987. So, while many things may have been lost, they did manage to hold on to that. So, anything else you want to talk about the wonderful opening credits? Because this song does absolutely nothing for me at all. It's like the most middle-of-the-road song in the whole film. And there's some meandering songs in here, but I think it's because I have pretty visuals to distract myself with that I don't really tend to notice them as much. But this song just seems like it just doesn't seem to go anywhere. And it's a bunch of information that when you're a kid, it has no interest in you at all. And you compare it to other fantasy opening sequences like Legend, for example. You've got world building there. Even like Neverending Story, you've got more world building there. With this, we've just got sparkly text all over the screen.
It's not so much world building as someone going, Neverending Story. It's like, yes, I know. It was on the title of it was on the DVD cover. Like, whereas this is more like, opening titles are great, and then we hit into Underground, which is actually no, I don't think do we hit Underground in the opening credits?
Not until she crosses the road, right at the end.
Yeah, so we won't talk about Underground yet. I love the opening titles as a song. I think it's great.
Good for you. So, that's all I gotta say. I mean, like, what you like at the end of the day.
I know what you mean, it's different, but you know, this was trying to be different. This wasn't trying to be a sword and sorcery set in a medieval Renaissance period. It was like contemporary American girl is sucked into fantasy land, Alice in Wonderland, Wizard of Oz, but like modern. So I think it works. I think it reflects that quite nicely. And then the first shot we see is of Sarah in the park reading aloud from what I always assumed was some sort of play, possibly a novella. But regardless, she's acting it out in full costume, in broad daylight, in the park. I was like, this movie is about me. I'm on board. I was already on board, and now I'm even more on board.
Were you one of those kids who like went to the park and acted out your favourite fantasy scenes?
Yes, I took it so many steps further. I would do it on the playground. I would put on mini Shakespeare plays in the playground and get people to watch. When I got to high school, I would put on mini musical productions at lunchtimes and got people to pay to come and see them. I would just constantly be like producing, directing, starring in my own work at the age of like 9.
Yeah.
So yeah, instantly I'd look at Sarah and I was like, hell yeah, that's someone I can get behind. Such a dramatic opening.
It is. I mean, she's here in a very beautiful gown, which Pinterest is all over if you ever wanted to match Sarah's style.
Nice. I mean, I used to dress like her. I used to borrow my mum's old waistcoat from the 80s, and I got like a big old fluffy pirate shirt, and I would wear like the right colored jeans, and I would try and straighten my hair to look like her, but it's no big deal. Like, everyone's did that, right? Everyone copied the movie characters' outfits, even if they were completely wrong for the fashion and time that you were living in, right?
I find that all my like my female friends who are like bloggers or podcasters, they had like these such free childhoods to engage in like fantasy and comb their hair with a fork and engage in such fantasy. And like for like all the guys, it was like if you did this, you was like in primary school, you had this as like your playground games, and then you normally sort of transitioned it into, you know, some sort of fantasy creative thing, whether you'd like doing it in like wargaming or you were writing stuff. I mean, once I discovered like doing roleplay games and like Dungeons and Dragons and stuff, I was just sorted. It's sort of like, oh, this material I've been building up for years, it's like finally got somewhere to use for it.
Yeah,
it gives you finally somewhere to be when the girls aren't calling. So
nice.
It was like, and we can all be lonely together. So,
if we're together, we're not lonely.
Yes, it's like if you drink on your webcam, it's not drinking alone.
It counts. Yeah, exactly.
Opening shot. It's a shot at West Wycombe Park here in the UK. It's nice. On the grounds of this very, very nice country house that was built between 1740 and the 1800s, and is currently owned by the National Trust, so you can actually go and visit the grounds during the spring and autumn months, reenact your favourite scenes from the movie.
From this and probably many Austin movies, because I'm pretty sure that's the Dashwood family home from Pride and Prejudice or Sense and Sensibility or whatever. It'll have been used in some thing, I reckon.
Unfortunately, I don't have a list of places that have things have been shot here, although it's got a number of interesting buildings. Then the lake itself is shaped like a swan.
Aww.
And it's created from the nearby River Wye. And the original, the lake when it was originally built, actually had a boat or a snow that even had a captain on board. And the Dashwood guests would be sailed around the lake for their amusement. So,
aww.
But yeah, there's a number of
what the hell?
What's that?
Sorry, I just tried to get there by train, and it tells me it's gonna take 8 hours.
I would say it's over in London, where I think so.
Yeah, it takes me through London. It's fine. Cut this out. It's fine. I was just like, I want to go visit, but I guess I won't because it's gonna take me 8 hours.
There's 5,000 acres of ground, and there's a number of buildings in there, most of them based on a lot of Greek and Roman archaeology, and you've even got the Temple of Apollo, which was originally used for cockfighting.
Nice.
So, take with them will, but yes, there's a whole... sounds like a really fascinating place to visit, and when you look at it in the film, it's just perfect. It's the sort of fantasy park that you want to go and reenact scenes from this play. And I don't know about yourself, but for years I was like trying to find out if it was a real book she was reading, and these are like in the pre-internet days, so you like read anything with the word labyrinth and hoping it's the right one, and just normally end up reading a lot of bad fantasy
or stuff about the Minotaur.
Yes,
yeah. Like how in Ever After she has Thomas More's Utopia, which is a real book that I then bought in an attempt to be like, I'm going to read Thomas More's Utopia, like my hero, Danielle. And then I was like, this sucks. This is really boring. This is like a political breakdown of his ideal world. Like, this is really boring. This is not at all what I expected. But unfortunately, The Labyrinth isn't a real book. And if it was, it might also be a political breakdown of someone's ideal political system. So... who knows? But she's reading from it. She's like almost looking straight to camera, so it like really gets you straight off. And she opens with that fantastic, iconic monologue. Like, what great opening lines to have for your movie. Like, just so poetic and cool. And again, it's sort of introducing us to its own world. It feels Shakespearean. It feels like it pre-exists, but it doesn't. And yet you feel like now you're in a place where this has always happened. I don't know. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I think we learn a lot about Sarah's character just from this opening, really. I mean, here we have a girl who's lives very much in a sort of fantasy world. We've got, if you read a little deeper into the character herself, I mean, her mother is an actress, so she has these sort of theatrical whims about herself. And the fact that she has a dog called Merlin, and as we'll see in the upcoming scenes when we look at her bookcase, there's many different sort of fantasy elements that will play into the labyrinth sort of mythos. But it's very clear that she would rather live in this sort of fantasy world of her own creation than have to deal with the realities of the real world. And I think in many ways it also helps the transition from when we go from the modern world into the world of the labyrinth, which is kind of medieval in its sort of style. So it's,
yeah, and it's like aesthetic, sort of old.
Yeah, and it means that we don't have the usual fish out of water sort of circumstance where you have someone from the modern world go into the past, and it's sort of like, oh, aren't you all backwards and stuff? It's like, no, she's just sees all these things, and she's immediately enchanted by the fact there's fairies, and it gives us a chance to play off all the usual conceptions of what things are. Like, fairies are always seen as cute and angelic, but they're actually horrible, vicious things, the same as unicorns. But
yeah, and I think that's why I always liked it. I think because not once is she like, gosh, where am I? Oh, what's going on? She's just like, yes, finally. Fantasy, weird fantasy world that I'm in now. Let's go, let's go. Because I feel like that's what I would have been like if I'd have been whisked away at 14. I'd have been like, fuck yeah, taking enough time. Let's fucking go. What do you want me to do? Save it? Yeah, let's fucking go for it. Woo! Like, I wouldn't be like, oh God, where am I? What's going on? Yeah, so I think that's really endearing. And yeah, you're absolutely right. This scene completely establishes that. And doesn't weird us out either when we start seeing creepy, weird stuff. But yeah, and then the clock tower chimes. And, oh no, Merlin, it's 6 o'clock. And Merlin is a gorgeous... What kind of dog? It's like the Dulux dog.
That's what I always call them. It's a... yeah. I would say an old English sheepdog.
Like an old English sheepdog, yeah. I think that's what he is.
I would love to see anyone try and herd sheep with this dog. Or this breed of dog, should I say. Unless you've got very slow sheep, I cannot see it being particularly, you know, a great idea. But then again, poodles are French gun dogs. So, what do I know? Mm. And they're probably a lot better than normal sheep dogs, which try to herd everything. Because if you don't give a sheep dog something to herd, it will herd people. So you often find them like nipping your heels, and it's just like the most annoying thing in the world to have some bloody dog nipping at your heels. So,
yeah. But nice. But yeah, and then that's pretty much the scene.
Oh, we get the owl. Which
yes, we get foreshadowing of the owl.
Which I feel that when you rewatch this again, we should perceive as being Jareth. Because he's take the form of the owl, so he's always watching.
We like know that. Yeah, on a rewatch, we know that that's Jareth, but he could also be a Jareth spy. I think it's really fun because you don't really see owls out in the day, especially in the movies. So already it's a bit sort of like, huh, that's an odd creature to have in the park. Like, any creature that's, like, watching a human is always pretty sus in a movie, because you're like, you would not be doing that. You would be minding your own damn business, finding food or breeding or doing many of the other animal things that you guys get up to. But so for an owl to sort of... So even when you're not sure that it's Jareth or anything to do connected with the labyrinth, it's still like, what's that owl up to?
Well, it has to be a very specific sort of animal. I mean, owls typically reference wisdom and light.
Which is so funny, because owls are so dumb. Like, owls are so dumb. But because Athena had an owl, everyone's like, owls are really smart. It's like, no, they're not. Like, Google it. Owls are dumb.
Okay. I never thought about this. But if you had, like, a crow or a raven, then it's got an unquestionable spooky edge, even though crows are extremely smart. Compared to owls, then, apparently. So, it's it has to be a very specific sort of animal.
Yeah.
And it has to be, like, something big. You can't just have, like, a budgie or a blue tit or something, because that just looks naff.
Yeah, well, it would look natural, wouldn't it? It needs to be something that stands out a bit. And they're majestic and they're cute. You know, I'm not completely coming for owls. I'm just like... You know, your wisdom's a bit overrated. I'm sorry. Like, there are cleverer birds than you, owl.
And it also fits in this perfect setting, because you can understand why Ceri goes to this park, because it feels like you're in a fantastical setting. And she, like, crosses over the bridge, and she's got the background. In the background, we see the Temple of Music, which makes just such a wonderful backdrop for this, you know, for this piece. And it's actually a situation on one of the islands there. So it's, in reality, it's actually part of the mausoleums and church portion of the grounds. But it looks really great when you look at the background. And I think because the actual landscape is not particularly cluttered, it's just like we've got that wonderful, you know, pond area or lake in the background. You've got the swans, you've got the dog, and everything's very sort of minimalistic, but it's got that sort of very fantastical tinge to it. And I think the fact she's here dressed in her gown, having a little fantasy moment, I think it just all perfectly comes together there.
Definitely. And we have not seen a puppet yet. no puppets yet. Just feel the need to, like, mark it down and be like, not a puppet yet, no puppets.
Nope.
All humans currently. But yeah, and the clock chimes and she starts to run, and that's the end of that chapter. So, woo!
Yeah, that's what's done for this this episode. Thank you for listening. If you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe button wherever you happen to be listening to us. And certainly share the episode with your friends. If you know any fans of Labyrinth out there, please do pass it on. Let them know what's happening over here. And you can follow us on both on Twitter and on Instagram. If you look up... just look for Through Dangers Untold, you will come up there. And if you want to email us, let us know about your goblin experiences. Not goblin experiences. Let us know about your
goblin experiences. Yeah. I would call it a goblin experience. I think that's perfectly what it is. When did you first watch it? How did it make you feel? Did you also have a sexual awakening to this movie? Let's go.
It's going to be a lot of people tense about what they thought when they saw Bowie in a cob piece and leather pants. It's like,
Which I will read every single one of those, and we will read them out on the show as well. So,
and something
do
we
email
also,
in.
Yeah. And also, please do let us know if you've got fan art, or if you know fan art that we should be checking out, or if you've got fan fiction. We want to hear anything that you want to share with us in relation to Labyrinth, as we would love to include it in the show. But you can send all that through to our email, which is throughdangersuntold99@gmail.com. We'd love to obviously hear from yourselves, and come and follow us on social media. Come be involved.
Join the conversation.
Yes, exactly. That's the word I was looking for. But until next time, thank you to my co-host Emily.
Woo!
And we'll be back with Chapter 2, Underground. But until then, good night.